Welcome to the Corner of Film podcast. I'm Niall from Corner of Film, which is a film website where I write about film. A few weeks back, I took a look at the dreams that inspired films, and one of those stories got me thinking about the way in which the films we love relate to our everyday lives. Now, Hollywood has a pretty loose relationship with the truth. Honestly, in most cases, we should probably be grateful, because real life is often messy, inconvenient, and, at risk of sounding like I'm in crisis, pretty unsatisfying, and none of those qualities are particularly conducive to a good film. With a story boiled down into a nice, digestible 2-hour period, it's unsurprising that truth and realism are often forced to take a back seat, and the gentle warp of reality is something that moviegoers have long since become accustomed to. However, many films come with the tagline, based on a true story. I've made my feelings on that branding pretty clear in previous episodes, but sometimes they really are true to life, and it often goes right over our heads. With that in mind, I've prepared 3 examples of the weird real-life stories that inspired popular films. Listen close, and you might just find that the truth can sometimes be stranger than fiction. To start us off, I figured I'd ease into things with something a little light-hearted. 50 First Dates is one of Adam Sandler's most successful films, due in no small part to the amnesia-fueled romance between Sandler's character Henry and his love interest Lucy. The general premise is that Henry falls in love with Lucy only to discover that she has a form of amnesia, which means that she forgets each day after living it. This is played off as a humorous barrier to romance instead of the horrific waking nightmare that it would actually be if you found yourself living with the condition. The strangest part of it is, as you might have guessed, that Henry and Lucy's relationship is actually based on a real-life couple. Far from the film's tropical Hawaiian backdrop, all the way in glamorous Spalding, Lincolnshire, live Michelle and Ian Philpotts. Back in 1985, Michelle was in a motorcycle crash that resulted in a brain injury. 5 years later, in 1990, she was in a car accident which resulted in another brain injury, and 4 years after that, in 1994, Michelle lost her short-term memory. It's a condition called anterograde amnesia, and it's defined as a loss of the ability to create new memories after the onset of amnesia, leading to a partial or complete inability to recall the recent past, while long-term memories from before the event remain intact. Are you with me so far? Unlike in the film, Michelle and Ian actually met in 1985 prior to her amnesia, and as such, she wakes every morning knowing who he is, but the couple didn't marry until 1997, which means that every morning Ian has to prove to Michelle that he's her husband. As you can imagine, Michelle's day-to-day life is filled with things like post-it notes and alarms to remind her to complete small tasks, and her car's sat-nav has to be programmed with her address so that she's able to find a way home after going out. As distressing as missing a quarter century of her memory must be, Michelle remains incredibly upbeat, and it's not hard to see why her unique condition would be used as the basis for a romantic comedy. After all, Michelle and Ian have enjoyed a loving relationship spanning over 3 decades, despite the many challenges that her condition presents. From weirdly sweet to just plain weird, I'd now like to take you back to a time when sci-fi and horror went hand in hand, and everyone's worst fear was little green men with large metal probes. The year was 1958, and a young Steve McQueen hit theatres in The Blob, a sci-fi horror about a gelatinous extraterrestrial mass that grows as it gorges itself on the population of small-town USA. The titular blob is an unflinching, emotionless force of nature intent on consuming everything in its path, something like the love child of a very hungry Jason Voorhees and any gelatin-based dessert. Now that's an image for you. Strangely enough though, the creature was in fact based in reality. 8 years before The Blob hit screens, it actually hit the Earth. At around 10 p.m. on the 26th of September 1950, Philadelphia police officers John Collins and Joe Keenan saw something falling from the sky. They said it looked a little like a parachute, and they estimated it to be roughly 6 feet across. They watched as it fell into a nearby field. Now, as police officers, they were sort of obliged to investigate, but they weren't willing to do so alone. They called for backup, which came in the form of Sergeant Joseph Cook and Patrolman James Casper, and the 4 men headed over to the area where the object had landed. What they found was a purple ooze draped across a mass of weeds, so light that it wasn't bending any of the plants. They shined their torches on it and noticed the mass giving off a misty purple glow, and on closer inspection, they believed that the mass contained crystals. Collins tried picking it up, but as he touched it, it began to dissolve, leaving a sticky, odourless residue on his hands. Over the next 25 minutes, the 4 men watched as the mass continued to dissolve until there was nothing left. The FBI were called about the purple mass, but without any real proof, the officer's story was ultimately dismissed as a possible hoax. It was repeated across America in various newspapers and radio shows, and thus the idea for the blob was born. There have actually since been a number of cases, and many have speculated that the substance is either some form of liquid meteorite or animal regurgitation. The latter is traditionally favoured as the most reasonable explanation, although after a 2009 incident, scientists were actually able to test some of the substance. After conducting their tests, they concluded that there was no DNA of any kind in any of the samples. Whatever you believe about the blob's origins, it certainly does make for a good story, albeit one with far less death and destruction than its big screen counterpart. Usually, death is added in as a means of heightening the drama, but every so often the opposite happens. The morbid drama is played down to make the narrative a little cleaner. This particular point brings us to the final true movie story of this week's podcast. Speaking of the truth, you want the truth? You can't handle the truth! That's what they say in the... 1992 courtroom drama A Few Good Men stars Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson and tells the story of two Marines court-martial after a man dies as a result of a brutal hazing ritual. The truth behind the film is a little more complicated and a lot more fascinating. The story that inspired the film and the play it's based on begins with Private William Alvarado. After being stationed at Guantanamo Bay in 1986, Alvarado wrote letters to a Texas congressman complaining of the conditions on the base, as well as various illegal activities that he'd witnessed, including Marines unprofessionally firing shots across the fence line into Cuba. Alvarado requested a transfer off the base. The private's letters reached Colonel Samuel Adams, who decided not to grant the transfer in spite of concerns that Alvarado's complaints and his violation of the chain of command would put him in danger. These concerns proved to be true. On the base, there was actually an unofficial group of Marines known as the Ten. In order to join this elite group, each of the Ten reportedly had to pass a series of intense physical challenges, such as hanging by hand over a 60-foot drop for at least 1 minute, and running several miles in full gear in intense heat. Sounds like fun. For what they considered to be dishonourable conduct, the Ten were encouraged to punish Alvarado with something known as a Code Red, and so, at 1:30 a.m. on a Sunday, they entered Alvarado's quarters. They restrained Alvarado and bound him with tape, then stuffed a pillowcase into his mouth to serve as a gag. He was blindfolded and beaten before being dragged from his room. The Ten's intention, other than roughing the private up a little, was to shave him bald as punishment, but it quickly became apparent to them that something had gone wrong. He began choking and spitting up blood as his lungs filled with fluid, then turned purple as he lost consciousness. The Ten abandoned the Code Red, calling for help, and Alvarado was rushed to the infirmary, then onto a hospital in Miami where he eventually made a full recovery. The Ten admitted their guilt and were arrested. The Marines were offered a plea bargain. They could get away without any criminal charges or convictions, but face a dishonourable discharge from the Marines, or they could proceed to a court-martial in which they'd be tried for attempted murder and conspiracy to commit murder. Seven of the Ten accepted the plea bargain, and all of them but platoon leader Christopher Lee Valdez were given a dishonourable discharge. Somehow, Valdez was able to have his discharge upgraded to honourable. The story shifts focus here to David Cox, one of the three that turned down the plea bargain. The trio's reasoning for rejecting the deal was that they said they'd committed the act on orders from a commanding officer, and that murder had never been the intention. The resulting court-martial lasted 4 days, and the three were cleared of the murder and conspiracy charges. Cox was found guilty of simple assault, although the charge was dismissed to time served. Cox remained with the Marines for 3 more years and was honourably discharged from his service in September of 1989. Cox led a pretty normal life after the Marines, moving in with his girlfriend and working a string of odd jobs while working towards a 2-year paralegal degree. Elsewhere, the events that had led to Cox's court-martial had been relayed in part to a young playwright by the name of Aaron Sorkin, who quickly penned A Few Good Men, and the play was attracting attention. It had a successful 14-month run on Broadway before Castle Rock Entertainment purchased the rights and started work on the film adaptation. When Cox found out, he was more than a little upset. Not only had the film put a fictionalised version of him up on the screen for the world to see, but he felt that it did him little justice given his continued service after the incident. This was a sentiment shared by several other members of the Ten, and 5 of them filed a lawsuit against the film seeking $10 million in damages. Cox wasn't officially a part of the lawsuit, although he had been asked to join and was considering doing so. Sadly, he never got the chance. On the 5th of January 1994, Cox's girlfriend Elaine Tinsley woke him before leaving for work. He was waiting on a call from UPS, who he'd been temporarily working for, to find out whether or not they'd keep him on permanently. Tinsley called home on her lunch break, but there was no answer. She checked their messages and found that UPS had called and offered Cox the job. She tried again that afternoon to reach him, but once more, there was no answer. Returning home that evening, she found his truck in the driveway with the keys in the ignition. There was an uncashed paycheck on the dashboard and his 9mm had been left in the glove box. There was no sign of a home invasion, although Tinsley noted that all of the house's interior doors had been left open and her pet rabbit had been let out and was hopping freely around the place. She definitely had cause for concern, but there was no evidence of anything sinister having taken place. After calling around friends and family to no avail, Tinsley reported Cox missing to the police. Despite searches and pleas to the media, there were no clues whatsoever as to what had happened to Cox. It wasn't until the 2nd of April, nearly 3 months later, that Cox was finally found. A man canoeing down the Charles River noticed a shoe sticking out of some branches and approached to find the body of David Cox in a wooded area a significant distance from the nearest road. The area was between two hunting ranges, which the police later believed to indicate that the murder was planned. Gunshots in the area wouldn't likely attract any attention. Cox had been killed execution style, one shot to the back of the neck, then three more to his left torso. Cox was found wearing his military-issue camouflage jacket, something which his family insisted he never usually wore. It's believed that Cox had gone along willingly with his killer, and this, combined with the businesslike style of his death, has led to speculation that the killer was someone linked to his military past. There were no leads, however, and the case went instantly cold. To this day, Cox's killer has never been found. The story behind A Few Good Men, and the mysterious death that followed, would likely make for a great movie of its own, which leads us down a dark and dangerous path in which true stories lead to more true stories, which lead to more true stories. Wait a minute, isn't that just life? That brings us to the end of this week's podcast. As always, I researched, scripted, and edited the whole thing myself, so if you're interested in learning more about any of the stories I shared today, just drop a message to Corner of Film and I'll happily share my sources with you for a little further reading. Please do follow Corner of Film on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook and YouTube at Corner of Film, and remember that you can listen to the podcast on Spotify, YouTube, Amazon Music and Podbean, which is a really great platform if you enjoy the art of the pod. If you can, please drop a like, subscribe, follow or rating on your platform of choice. It will help spread the good Corner of Film word. I hope you've enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed making this episode, and stay tuned for next week when I'll be back with another. I've been Niall from Corner of Film, and you've been listening. No, still need a better sign-off. Goodbye!